shimmer is a floor wax.
No, new shimmer is a dessert topping.
It's a floor wax.
It's a dessert topping.
It's a floor wax, I'm telling you.
It's a dessert topping, you cow!
Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
I'm Ken Reardon, and Ron, this is not a podcast, it is a tax.
It's a penalty either way for the listener. Ken, I think we can probably slap each other back and forth about this a few times. Which do you think? Is it a penalty or is it a tax?
It is the question that is beguiling the Romney campaign, and we saw this week from not only Eric Etch-a-Sketch Fernstrom, and now Mitt Romney has come out this week and said, well, you know something, the Republican Party is right, I'm wrong, it's not a penalty, it is a tax.
Okay. The irony here, right off the top, is that the contradiction really ought to be afflicting the White House and the president, because they are the people who insisted all along that the individual mandate in the health care law that was passed into law in 2010 was a penalty and not a tax, because they had promised not to pass any taxes on the American people, or certainly not any middle-class people, after the 2008 campaign. But this is not an issue about how you finance health care. This is an issue about how you get people to go out and get health insurance who have not done it voluntarily. And it is, therefore, a goad, an incentive to make them pay a certain amount of money if they don't. Now, is that a penalty or is it a tax?
Well, you're talking about the wording in the law. What you really we should be talking about and what we really are talking about is the political implications here. And that is, if it is a tax for Obamacare, if that's a tax, then what Mitt Romney put through as governor of Massachusetts and Romney Care has to be a tax as well.
You're talking about consistency now.
Well,
you're saying that Romney would be contradicting himself.
The governor believes that what we put in place in Massachusetts was a penalty, and he disagrees with the court's ruling that the mandate was a tax. But again,
so he agrees with the president, and he believes that you shouldn't call the tax penalty a tax. You should call it a penalty or a fee or a fine.
That's correct. But the president also needs to be held accountable for his hypocritical and contradictory statements.
So in the end, Eric Fernstrom is being barbecued again for saying what was, in fact, the official, if not official, certainly the widely acknowledged truth about the strategy of the Romney camp.
I think the Romney campaign would have loved to have put the onus on Obama, saying that it was truly a tax and Obama is not recognizing it, when ultimately it really seemed to backfire on Romney.
It has, partly because Fernstrom, when he made these remarks a few days earlier in the week, was clearly speaking what made sense, what was the logical extension of the Romney position from Massachusetts. And I don't believe that he was doing this off on his own. I think this was what the campaign thought it should be saying.
They've been saying it all along.
And then they turned around. They turned around later in the week when they saw the reaction from a lot of Republican quarters, which were suddenly savaging Romney in the same way that they had been savaging John Roberts, the Chief Justice, for the opinion that he wrote in the health care law decision the Supreme Court handed down last week. So, you know, all of a sudden the firing squad is turned on Romney. So the candidate himself does a CBS News interview with Jan Crawford on Wednesday morning, and on the day of the 4th of July, maybe thinking that the rest of the country wouldn't be paying attention, the candidate himself said this.
Well, the Supreme Court has the final word, and their final word is that Obamacare is a tax. So it's a tax. They decided it was constitutional. So it is a tax, and it's constitutional. That's the final word. That's what it is. Now, I agreed with the dissent. I would have taken a different course, but the dissent was in the majority. The majority has ruled, and their rule is final.
The question I have is that, look, this is the gaffe du jour that we like to talk about, and ultimately, I don't know what it means. Yes, it's another indication of Mitt Romney flip-flopping, but I think he judged accurately that describing this as a tax is better for his campaign in the long run.
What he can say is, actually, folks, it's the president who has lacked integrity in his own program and political presentation. And that, I think, is a pretty decent argument for their camp if they can just get the candidate to articulate it a little better, which, by the way, is the White House's problem in defending the whole health care law, which from the very outset in the spring of 2009, they have failed to explain, they have failed to make sound appealing, and they have allowed their opponents to define.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, if you look at the poll numbers all along, even as Congress was passing it, even in the moments leading up to the Supreme Court decision, the numbers still didn't favor the White House. The numbers were still not a majority, but a net negative on the Affordable Care Act. Now, it seems like with the court having done what it did, having, you know, John Roberts betraying America and violating the Constitution in deciding the 5-4 decision.
You are putting that in quotation marks.
I am. A little irony.
A little irony marks?
Yeah,
little
yes.
Irony. Okay.
But in the time since the decision, it seems like there has been a slight uptick in those supporting the law. But again, the complaint about the White House has always been from the beginning that they've still not been able to sell the plan. I mean, it's still, the nation is still split on it, even in the aftermath of what is basically a historic affirmation of Obama's top legislative accomplishment.
All right, and you bring up a good point there. John Roberts, and I know you were being ironic a moment ago when you talked about him, you know, being a traitor and going back on the Constitution and so on, but these are exactly the kinds of things that are being said about John Roberts by the people who had been his greatest admirers, who had been his acolytes.
But think of the people who hated the court, including President Obama, everything from Bush versus Gore to Citizens United, the word from the progressive wing of the political spectrum is that the court is just, you know, so far to the right and so political. And so now suddenly John Roberts has become Earl Warren. We're impeaching Earl Warren again, you know, and it's just remarkable how that's changed.
I think it's astonishing partly because many of the people who are savaging him most viciously are people you would think would appreciate, number one, that he did not go for the justification of the individual mandate on the basis of the Commerce Clause. They were very interested in seeing the Commerce Clause delimited by this decision, and that's exactly what John Roberts did. He gave them a totally federalist society, conservative view of the Commerce Clause that will become a precedent and matter a great deal to Supreme Court rulings probably for many, many years. They should be in triumph about that. They should be celebrating that. I can't believe this is going to change a lot of people.
No, I agree. I agree. Ultimately, it will be about the economy. And I mean, I think both sides agree. But it's just interesting how they're approaching it. This week, President Obama is having a 2-day bus tour of northern Ohio and western Pennsylvania, and obviously two states that are crucial to his reelection. And he seems to be, President Obama is talking about not so much, here's what I've done in the last 3 years, but if you elect Mitt Romney, the architect of this great outsourcing of jobs.
You mean the guy who shipped all your jobs overseas,
exactly,
Ohio.
Exactly.
I'm the guy who brought them back by turning the auto industry around, and look at those auto sales numbers.
What a president believes matters. Mitt Romney's companies were pioneers in outsourcing U.S. jobs to low-wage countries. He supports tax breaks for companies that ship jobs overseas. President Obama believes in insourcing. He fought to save the U.S. auto industry and favors tax cuts for companies that bring jobs home.
Obviously, this is the new Obama ad this week, and this is the line of attack, basically. It is not about the last 3 years. It is about Mitt Romney, the outsourcing of jobs, what he did at Bain Capital, what he will do as president of the United States.
That's right. Not a referendum on the economy, not a referendum on the last 3 years, but a referendum on Mitt Romney, whether or not he was a bad guy when he was a businessman.
And we've also seen this week, we've seen Rupert Murdoch, we've seen the Wall Street Journal, we've seen people in the Romney corner saying that he is just not aggressive enough in standing up to the Obama attack. Given the fact that the economy is sputtering, or somewhat sputtering.
Faltering.
Given the fact that the job creation is not what President Obama would like or what the American people would like, the fact that Romney is still on the defensive this week over the Supreme Court decision, over Bain Capital, things like that, it just getting people very nervous. Even though we are still talking about it's early July, but pretty soon it's going to be early August, and then that's followed by early September. And then after that, would be early October.
Okay, I think
yeah.
I get the drift where
yeah.
that's going.
Yeah.
I see it. All right, one other question we have about Mitt Romney as we...
And then followed by early November.
And by the time we get to early November, we expect to know the identity of Mitt Romney's running mate. Ken, who will that person be?
Well, it will not be Chris Christie. And here's an example of why it will not be Chris Christie.
Governor, on Monday, are you going to be addressing the legislature?
Did I say on topic? Are you stupid? On topic. Next question. Good. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you all very much. And I'm sorry for the idiot over there. Take care.
I think that's presidential.
Yeah, obviously he's been listening to the podcast, and I think he was referring to you, Ron.
I think that's entirely possible.
If he asked,
are you stupid, he must have been talking to me.
Wait, one guy's stupid and one guy's the idiot.
Oh, you think that's two different guys?
Well, look, he's not. That's what. But you know who he could be? He could be the keynote speaker. I think he was the kind of guy who they would love to get him in Tampa at the end of August, fire up the crowd.
Yes.
But not go from state to state as his running mate. I still say Rob Portman, not Mr. Excitement. And it's not because he's going to win in Ohio. I just think there's a comfort level with somebody like Portman, and this is the way that Romney sees the presidency and the vice presidency, and that's why I think it's going to be him.
You know, for so many months I was buying chairs of Marco Rubio and explaining why he had the
trifecta. You were yelling that in the swimming pool this weekend.
I was.
Marco Rubio. Yeah.
And I...
You were right.
It's just sometimes it's like a brain freeze. Sometimes that joke. I was making the point.
Oh wait, and then it's followed by early December.
I kept saying about Marco Rubio, but he was the perfect trifecta candidate. He was Tea Party, he was Hispanic, and he got you Florida. And those are incredibly important things to Mitt Romney. All three of those, and yet Marco Rubio does not seem to have essentially held up under the pressure of being, in a sense, the front runner for vice president. He seems to recede with every passing week. There was some question about whether the campaign had even asked for his various credentials to be vetted. And I don't think that he is anymore in the frame. I think it's increasingly clear that they are focused on Rob Portman. They keep leaking one story after another to major frontline media to suggest that they are really serious about Rob Portman.
Well, look, if you want to excite the crowd, if you want to excite the convention, if you want to pull a Sarah Palin, and I mean that in a positive way, in the fact that she did electrify the convention at St. Paul 4 years ago, if you want to do that, then you do a Marco Rubio. If you want to govern as a team, then you do a Rob Portman type. And in fact, I think you do it much earlier than expected. Usually, you know, you do it like a week or so before the convention, and then you have this triumphant entry into Tampa and excites the Republican faithful.
Right through the Arc de Triomphe, which is in Tampa.
Ron, another name on the VP list, Adriano Espaillat.
Adriano Espaillat.
Yeah, what do you think?
I think he is a few years away, but you know what? That guy is shooting very high. He's already in the New York State Senate, correct?
Right.
He ran against Charlie Rangel, almost beat him, within what looks like 800 votes in the count.
Well, here's the story. Let me just describe the new 13th district in New York. When Charlie Rangel beat Adam Clayton Powell in 1970, it was an overwhelmingly African-American district, three-quarters black. The center was Harlem, which was the center of black political activity in the United States. In this new restructured district, it is majority Latino, including a lot of areas in the Bronx where Espaillat represents in the state Senate. And it just seems like it was pretty remarkable that in many of these Hispanic districts, notably in the Bronx, not a single vote was recorded there. And which
like nobody showed up at the polls? Is that what somebody was saying?
Well, and this is what's so remarkable about this, is that the Latino community and the black community in New York, which have long been at odds, it's a question of an up-and-coming voting bloc versus an old established voting bloc, which is the African-American community. And so the Espaillat people are accusing their opponents of voter suppression. And usually you hear black voters talking about white vote suppression, and that's been a historic argument for going back for decades. And yet it's kind of interesting, the Latino community hurled these same kind of accusations at the black political establishment.
We cannot have a Florida-type situation in New York State. It's just impossible that in the northeast of our country, we have a situation similar to what happened in Florida between Gore and Bush.
So where it stands right now is that Charlie Rangel has an 802-vote lead. The Espaillat campaign still has the option of calling for a new election. If that happens, I mean, that's going to be much more ugly.
I don't see it being likely that there would be a special election.
I agree.
There are a couple of thousand votes remaining to be counted. Espaillat would have to win 3-1 or something like that.
Erase the 802 vote
that's
lead.
That's right. And that's very unlikely. These are absentee ballots. They're not all coming from certain precincts. They're ballots that have already been cast. And given the fact that Governor Cuomo and the rest of the Democratic Party establishment in New York pretty much lined up at the last minute behind Charlie Rangel, they're not likely to call for a new election, which, as you say, would be very divisive. But I would say that barring the unforeseen, Esbayat is going to be back in just 2 years and run against Charlie Rangel again, if in fact Charlie Rangel even runs again in 2014. And my guess is he will retire.
Although we did say that after the tough 2010 that Charlie Rangel had, culminating in the lowest, even though it was 80% of the vote, the lowest reelection margin of his career, followed a month later by a censure by the full House, many people thought that Charlie Rangel was going to wrap it up after 2010, and here he comes back in 2012. Look, the feeling is that a lot of Democrats want Charlie Rangel to go out on his own decision, and one would think that after a very close race in 2012, this would be the last time. But with Charlie Rangel, you never know.
One note before we conclude today. We are noting the passing this week of Andy Griffith, who was an entertainer and not a politician, but who was someone who took a lively interest in politics and, somewhat unusually for someone with his particular demographic of appeal, was a big supporter of President Obama.
Not only that, I do remember in the 1980s, Democrats were desperate for Andy Griffith to run against Jesse Helms in North Carolina for the Senate. When you think of him, you think of Mayberry and you think of the Andy Griffith Show. You don't think of somebody very strong politically, and you certainly don't think of him as a Democrat, but actually, behind the scenes, Andy Griffith was a big supporter of Democratic causes. And had he wanted to, could have been a political star in the state of North Carolina.
And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage in the beginning of February, then the beginning of March, at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Reardon.
Join us again next week and bring your patience. It's All Politics from NPR.